Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to Alive to Thrive with Brenda Fraser. Each week, Brenda brings you timely topics in art, culture, and film. Her guests are change agents, business leaders, authors, people who will inspire you. Join Brenda on Fridays at noon Central, or listen to her podcast on demand 24/7. Please visit and like facebook.com/alive to thrive. And now, here's Brenda.
Thank you, Sean. Thank
you. We'd like to sing another number. Hey, all right, this is another song. This. I lay a say alone, may I say, my say alone. And this song goes Nowhere Man in E.
He's a real nowhere man.
Hello and welcome to Alive to Thrive. That was a small snippet from Nowhere Man by the Beatles. And I love the Beatles. My sister got to see them in 1964. And it's also a favorite band of my guest today, who is actually a somewhere man. He is someone who has been in no man's land and was probably considered a nowhere man, but has turned his life around. And I had the honor of meeting William Cope Moyers last summer. He was in Missouri speaking about his book called Broken, My Story of Addiction and Redemption. And I was riveted to my chair. His tale was so authentic. He's completely transparent. And he shares some incredible stories of the years that he was living in hell and his recovery from drugs and alcohol. So I want to welcome to the program, William, are you with us today?
Yes, Brenda. Good day to you. Thanks for having me on. I'm always honored to be able to carry my message of hope and help and healing to people wherever they are, and to be with you today gives me the opportunity to reach your audience with this same message.
Well, I appreciate it. It took a couple of months here to get you scheduled, and I know you are often on the road traveling back and forth to Washington, D.C., and not only speaking about your book, but representing the organization that you have faithfully served at Hazleton up there in Minnesota for a few years as Vice President of Public Affairs and Community Relations. Probably a position you didn't expect you'd be doing, say, 30 years ago, right?
Oh no, that's the miracle of the journey, Brenda. The wonderment that I have in my life is the result of more than I could have ever expected. The fact that I could have become addicted to alcohol and other drugs, I never imagined that when I began to experiment as a teenager, smoking marijuana and then drinking legally at the age of 18 way back when. Never imagined I could have come into the grip of addiction. And there was a time when I never imagined I could find freedom from substances. And never really did I imagine that even when I did finally find that freedom and get into recovery, never did I imagine that I would go to work for the very organization that I got treatment from twice. And that all these decades later, I would be in the position that I am today at Hazel and Betty Ford, where I carry the message, do public policy, do fundraising, do media relations, write books, and most of all, help people. I think, you know, in the same way that I was helped so long ago by my family and my friends, my employer, I now have the ability to give back on a day-to-day basis and help other people. And I guess really the bottom line is even though I've been doing it for a long time, I do still have that sense of wonderment over the miracle that has transformed my life and has put me where I am today.
Well, it makes me think of the line I've heard often about, you know, God has a sense of humor, and if we got what we only asked for, we'd be, you know, that we're given so much more than we could ever imagine, beyond our wildest dreams. You know, once people have turned their lives around and found a spiritual solution, and I heard you say once that, you know, alcoholism is a disease that has no cure but has a solution. And we're going to be talking about that today and breaking down some of the myths and stereotypes. I think you are such a powerful messenger because so many people have a stereotype of what is an alcoholic. I know myself, that was not a term I ever heard growing up. I didn't really ever think about alcoholism. And if you asked me 30 years ago, if I knew what an alcoholic was, it would probably be someone, you know, stereotypically homeless, living under a bridge, you know, without a family, without a job, without anything. And I think people like yourself who are highly educated, who come from, you know, so-called good families with, you know, every opportunity presented to you, and where, you know, maybe people are wired differently. I've heard someone say they think they were born with an addictive personality. Do you think you had the disease prior to ever picking up any substance?
No doubt. I, with the benefit of hindsight, of course, and we all have, we all benefit from the hindsight of our own lives. I've looked back on that truth, and slowly but surely, more of it's been revealed as I've stayed in recovery longer and longer over the decades. I've had the benefit of hindsight, and looking back now, there's no doubt in my mind that I was an alcoholic and a drug addict before I ever used those substances. And what I mean by that is that there's more to the illness than just an inability to just say no to alcohol or pain medication or marijuana. It is an illness, to me at least, an illness of the mind and the body and the spirit. And my problem is less about living life under the influence, and it's more about living life without being under the influence. In other words, I have a challenge in living in the real world, life on life's terms. I'm one who likes to heighten the highs and mitigate the lows. My issue is being restless, irritable, and discontent in my own body, and so I'm always trying to change my reality. And long before I discovered that alcohol and other drugs could change my reality, I sought to do so in other ways, by acting out and trying to make myself the center of attention, even when I was in kindergarten. So, yes, I have the illness. I have an inability to use substances responsibly or moderately. But much more than that, mine is, that sense of not being good enough, wanting to be better than. I think perfectionism has a lot to do with it. I call it a hole in the soul. I know you've heard me talk about that before, but I have a hole in the soul that really is all about my not being comfortable in my own skin. Like I said, being restless, irritable, and discontent. I discovered the answer for that when I was 15 years old, when I smoked marijuana for the first time. And I didn't smoke marijuana to become addicted any more than I smoked it to find the answer. I smoked because it was made available to me and because I thought that's what all teenagers did. But when I smoked it, I suddenly found the answer to what ailed me. I didn't have to try so hard anymore to be perfect or to have that sense of belonging. That marijuana and later alcohol, that soothed my hole in the soul. And from then on, I was off to the races.
And I think people that, you know, can identify with your description in your book, which I want to mention again, is called Broken for the readers. It's available online through Hazleton and through Amazon. But when you were at Washington and Lee University in Lexington, Virginia, and you had grain alcohol punch, and I'm just reading that, and I reflected back on when I had grain alcohol punch in at my university. You know, I have described that as liquid gold going down my throat, and that warmth that spreads throughout your body. Only people that, you know, can identify with that statement might be, you know, people that have the disease, maybe not, but can you describe that sensation of when alcohol enters your body, how you think it acts differently than maybe someone that takes a sip and puts it down and drinks a glass of water and then takes another sip? And can you talk a little bit about that? Yeah.
Well, you know, substances are the elixir of my life. You know, like I said, I had no idea growing up that I had the genetic predisposition. By the way, my addiction is not an excuse. I don't use it as an excuse for anything that happened to me, but it does. But it does explain a lot. It explains why a rational person can act irrationally, why a moral person can do immoral things, why a good person can commit bad acts. It explains why a loving person can hurt those very people that he or she loves and are loved by. So I don't ever use it as an excuse, but it was the remedy. There's no doubt about it. I developed a perverse love affair with substances because they did for me what I could not do for myself. And like I said earlier, that they took care of my imperfections. They gave me a sense of belonging. They falsely, I mean, you know, long again, with the benefit of hindsight, I can see now that they didn't do what I thought they were doing, in the sense that I felt I was okay under the influence. I wasn't, clearly, but I felt like I was for a while, and, you know, for a while I did function in the world. But I had a sense of relief, a sense of belonging, a sense of peace, of closeness and harmony to the world when I was drinking. And I didn't have to be, you know, drinking the blackout to feel that way. I didn't have to use drugs even in excess to feel that way. But whenever I willingly put into my body a legal or an illegal substance, it served as the, you know, magic bullet to what ailed me. It gave me that sense of peace. It medicated that hole in my soul. And so I think a lot of people have that same experience. Not everybody, by the way, who, you know, drinks to blackout or uses cocaine or takes too many pain pills is automatically an addict and an alcoholic. I think through life, probably many people, you know, drink too much on New Year's or perhaps take one too many pain pills at some point. But what separates people who misuse substances or make a mistake once or twice with them from people like me is that when somebody does have a hangover or maybe even gets a DWI or finds themselves out of control by taking too many pain meds, they learn from that mistake or from that experience, and they don't do that again. That's good. But those of us who have the propensity to be addicted, we have those same experiences, but we don't learn from the bad things that happen. And so we keep doing them to the detriment of everything else that matters. Why? Because we're chasing that. We're chasing that elusive feeling, number one. And secondly, we can't stop of our own free will. So that's really, you know, I think a lot of us have had the experience of being under the influence of a legal or an illegal substance, but not everybody who has that experience becomes addicted. Only about 1 in 10 of us out there does, and I was one of them.
And so 1 in 10 become addicted, and then those that find a 12-step program or go to rehab facilities, what's the percentage of those that find recovery and stick with it versus, I mean, are there any statistics on relapse rates or people that find long-term recovery?
Well, yeah, that's the great mystery, isn't it? I mean, what is recovery? You alluded to people who go to rehab. I'm not real keen on that word, rehab, because, you know, rehab sort of suggests, it's used liberally and used in a way that people understand. I don't find fault with people that use it, but rehab is what we do when we, are having physical therapy or when we have a hip replacement or when we're fixing something that's broken or that needs strengthening. People who are addicted are no more in rehab than those who have cancer. They get treatment, and they go to a treatment facility to get help, whether it's for breast cancer or for alcoholism. And that's why I like the term, treatment. But I understand when people use the term rehab what they mean. I just think that it doesn't really give credit to the processes that are necessary for people to get well. Treatment suggests a medical condition that has expertise by doctors, therapists, and counselors in helping somebody like me overcome it. But I think the great mystery and what I've really focused on in all candor, Brenda, what I've thought a lot about, particularly in the last few years, is what is this thing called recovery? You mentioned 12-step programs. Yeah, the 12-step programs are a good way for people, some people, millions of people, to find recovery. But the telling statistic in that is that the federal government estimates there are roughly 25 million people in the United States who consider themselves, quote, in recovery, close quote, from substance use. Wow, so that's a lot of people, right? But at the same time, if you talk to AA in New York or some of the other 12-step programs, you'll find that they would tell you that at any given moment they have 2 to 3 million active members, meaning people who are attending such meetings on a regular or consistent basis. So, okay, that's good number two. You got 2 to 3 million in a 12-step program, but the federal government says there's 25 million of us. So where is everybody else? I mean, that's the great mystery. What is everybody else doing? Some go to treatment. Many are in 12-step programs, but a lot of others aren't. And so what are they doing? I don't know exactly. I'm sort of exploring that in my next book, which we can talk about. But I think the point is there are a lot of people recovering, and they recover differently. Some would consider themselves in recovery, but they might still drink on occasion. And I understand that. Some would consider themselves in recovery, but all they're doing is not using, or all they're doing is going to church, or all they're doing is exercising or running marathons. So it's hard to know what the outcomes to your question. It's hard to know what the outcomes are scientifically when we don't really even have, as a society, or even as a treatment industry, we don't really have a clear sense of what it is we're trying to measure. But there's no doubt. I mean, there are millions of us who are much better off than we were before, and I think that's the key. However you do it, however you recover, all that really matters is that you do it and that you do it in a way that restores your sense of dignity and respect, restores your family, and so on and so forth. But I can't tell you what the, quote, success rates, close quote, are for addiction recovery, because it's hard to know. I mean, there's so many different ways to measure it. Now, last thing on my long-winded answer.
Okay,
go ahead.
And then I want to ask you something. Go ahead. I want you finish your thought.
Well, all I was going to say is to the bottom line of your question. At the Hazel and Betty Ford Foundation, where I work, I'm based in Minnesota, we do follow-ups on our patients 12 to 18 months out, and what we find generally is that approximately 60% of our patients report they are continuously abstinent in the year after discharge from treatment. So does treatment work all the time? No, of course not. It's a chronic disease. Does it work a lot of the time? Absolutely. So there's this hope. When you go to treatment, you have a real chance to get better.
And sometimes it takes multiple treatments, and we'll talk about that in a minute because we'll get that back to your story. My question is that there are those that can afford treatment centers that may have insurance plans or private financial means to go. Here in Missouri, where I live, I know that a local treatment center has an 8-week waiting list, and in my opinion, if someone is at the verge of needing treatment or finally willing to go through family intervention or whatever, they may be dead before those 8 weeks actually transpire and they can get into that treatment center. So what is your advice to community leaders to either through, you know, more funding mechanisms, state, federal, or community-based response to provide more options for treatment?
Well, as you know, in Missouri, and as we know around the country, there is a crisis right now as it relates to opioids. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has identified the opioid problem as a, quote, epidemic, and they don't do that very often, identify something as an epidemic. There's a legitimate epidemic in this country on opioids. There's a continuous problem around alcohol and other drugs. Point being, there are far more people who need treatment. As you noted, waiting list in Missouri, there's far more people who need treatment than are able to access it, and there are a lot of reasons for that. There's not enough treatment in this country. There's not enough resources for treatment in this country. There's much more need. There's much more demand than there is availability, and that's tragic. We've been fighting at Hazel and Betty Ford and with other treatment facilities around the country. We've been fighting to expand access to care, and we are making some good inroads into that. But sadly, there are far too many people who continue to suffer with this illness who cannot access care, be it through their own insurance or through a publicly funded facility. That said, there is hope out there. And if you are a listener today who's struggling with substances or you're from a family, there is help available. You got to pick up the phone or get on the internet and find it, reach out and ask for help. We do, as I said earlier, there are more resources than ever before to access treatment, even though there still are not enough access points for that. And the big red flag that I would say, and I think Missouri was a red state in the last presidential election. I have a lot of friends in red states. I traveled through the South, especially last fall. I'd seen you in Missouri earlier in the summer, a lot of people in red states who are just as committed to addiction treatment and recovery as I am, but their political affiliation might not have been mine. Point being that we're going to see in public policy and in health policy in this country a rolling back or a dismantling of Obamacare. I know there are some issues with the Affordable Care Act, as it's known. I understand those issues. I understand why things need to be fixed. But the sad reality is, be careful what you ask for, because in the Affordable Care Act, addiction was covered, as was mental illness. And I hope we're not going to throw the baby out with the bathwater, because if we do that, if we repeal the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, and suddenly shut off access to treatment for people who need and deserve it, then we're only going to create more of a crisis in this country around access to care and finding recovery. Point being, if you're listening out there today and you're in favor of dismantling the Affordable Care Act, make sure then that you are an advocate for whatever comes next. So the Republicans, and I know addiction to be a bipartisan illness, and I don't want to say that one party is any more or less responsible than the other, but the Republicans and the Trump administration have said they're going to repeal Obamacare. Okay, if you're going to do that, let's make sure that addiction and mental illness continue to be covered in whatever is coming next. Otherwise, we're only going to exacerbate what is already a real problem in this country, and that's access to treatment.
I love that. You preempted a question I was going to ask you about the administration and what we see coming and just that role of being an advocate. And that was something that struck me in your talk as well, is that everyone can be an advocate on their local level, talking to their city council, to go to their state capitol and lobby their state legislature. And I know here in Missouri there's a public awareness event coming up. I just want to mention this because there's a local alderman on a health and wellness committee for the city of St. Peter's is doing a sort of a panel discussion for the public. It's called Let's Talk About Substance Abuse on Monday, February 27th. 6:30 to 8, and they will have, initially they were only going to have someone from law enforcement, and I recommended someone with long-term recovery who has started a rapid response team with his church and other community-based organizations. We will have someone from a high school who is a counselor, a licensed social worker, and someone else who is a therapist who treats addiction recovery from recovery to maintenance. And we had asked to get someone from the NCADA, the National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse, and they weren't available this particular day, but I do want to give out that name and website. So if people are listening either during live the program or to the recorded podcast, NCADA.org is a wonderful resource. They ran some powerful commercials during the Super Bowl. Did you see those?
I did,
William,
not.
Did you happen?
No.
Oh, my goodness. They were riveting, and they were about opiate addiction, the epidemic, and they really jumped out at me. I don't know if people who were drinking and watching the football game happened to pay attention, but, you know, there is a huge public awareness campaign going on throughout the country with the NCADA and other organizations like your own. Tell us a little bit about what you're doing with, working with Congress and what legislation might be pending that we can weigh in on with our local U.S. congressional delegation, and are you working with any states in particular? So let's start with the feds. What are you working on federally right now?
Well, policy, I believe, effective policy change comes from the bottom up, not from the top down. In other words, from the grassroots, down in the trenches, in the front lines of Springfield or St. Louis, or Kansas City, I mean, wherever you are out there listening, change begins with us being people in recovery, our families, you know, treatment facilities, recovery support groups. If we want to change public perception and change public policy, we do it by starting, as you noted, in our own communities. There's nothing more effective, nothing better, I believe, than change that occurs from the bottom up. That said, of course, law, especially federal law and funding, comes from Washington through our members of Congress in the House and in the Senate, who hear from us back in the districts wherever we live. And at the moment, we're all sort of, I wouldn't say we're holding our breaths, but we're watching to see who President Trump appoints as the next, quote, drug czar, the director of the Office of National Drug Control Policy, the drug czar's office, as most people would know it. You know, it's interesting. The president has a firsthand knowledge of the toll that alcohol takes. He had a brother. He's been open about this. President Trump had a brother, Freddie, who died of alcoholism back in the 1980s. So the president knows this issue intimately, as most families do. We hope that his intimate personal experience will translate into public policy coming out of Washington that emphasizes that addiction is an illness. It's a treatable illness. Treatment works, and people do recover en masse. So we hope that whatever comes out of Washington will be more funding for treatment, more funding for prevention, more funding for research into the disease of addiction, and also funding for recovery support organizations. They call them RCOs in communities. There are some very good ones in Missouri and other places. That the president, as of this moment, hasn't yet the drug czar. I made a point a few weeks ago in a column I wrote that I hope that when the president picks a drug czar, he not only picks a doctor who is knowledgeable in the science of addiction, but that he takes that position and he elevates it back to the cabinet. It doesn't look like that's going to happen because the president's talking now as if his cabinet is in place. But under President Bush and before that under Bill Clinton, President Clinton, the drug czar's position was a cabinet-level position, meaning that that person met with the president and the rest of the cabinet whenever there was a cabinet meeting. But unfortunately, under Obama, that position was de-escalated or was moved down a level. It's still an important position in the Obama administration, but it was not a cabinet-level position. So I think what we're really watching for and hoping for is a clear signal from the president and his administration that drug policy is as important as homeland security is, as important as immigration is, as important as health care and all those other things, and that the best signal he could send would be to have that position at the cabinet level. As it relates to specific legislation, it's too early right now to see where that's going. We've made some real good legislative strides in the previous administration, in the previous Congress, just as recently as last November. And by the way, the United States Surgeon General issued a report that we think is just groundbreaking on drug issues, as the Surgeon General's report was in 1964, on smoking. The Surgeon General released a report that not only gauges the impact of substance use problems in this country, but also gauges the impact of recovery. And that Surgeon General's report is out there for people to see and for people to use in their local communities. Because again, at the end of the day, how we change public policy in Missouri is down in cities, down in towns, on Main Street, in the farmland, and not should we depend on it coming from Washington. We change public perception, we change public policy with our own stories, with our own faces and our own voices.
I love that. And one of the stories you've shared on some of the videos that are on YouTube, I want to encourage listeners to just, you know, Google William Cope Moyer's name on YouTube and look at some of his speeches. But I love that when you were speaking in front of a Rotary Club, because I could totally picture this because I've spoken at Rotary Clubs, and where they're kind of nodding off. They've had a big lunch, and they're just sitting there taking a little snooze, and, you know, you just came right out with it. And, you were very outspoken about your story and identifying as someone who has had an addiction and is in recovery. Now, talk to me a little bit about the movie and the movement called Anonymous People, because it makes a very a lot of valid points, some which may be controversial within the recovery movement itself, about how visible to be and how outspoken to be, and it's almost like the movement is hurt by people being invisible, by not self-disclosing, because of certain traditions within certain 12-step programs about anonymity. Mm-hmm. So can you talk about that, the importance of sort of claiming your recovery and being more out about it, and how that can change policy?
Sure. There's nothing more important. You made a note of it, Mike. The first time I ever sort of went public or came out, if you will, was at a Rotary Club meeting back in the 90s, where I stood up and spoke out, not as an expert at the Hazelin Foundation, which is what we were then called, but as a person who had been there and done that. In other words, I identified myself that day as an alcoholic and an addict in recovery from addiction who got well because I had multiple treatments in the late 80s and early 90s. And that put a face and a voice to the issue, and that in a modest way that day helped to destigmatize the illness. In other words, mine is an illness that doesn't discriminate. You can come from a family of means and prominence like I did, or you can come from a broken family. You can be white, you can be black, you can be yellow, you can be brown, you can be college educated, you can be a high school dropout, you can be a woman, you can be a man, whatever. I mean, addiction doesn't discriminate, and the only way we're going to get people to really understand that is we're comfortable with it, is if we share our own stories. The reason why we, and other, just in the same way that other advocates for issues have, you know, people with HIV/AIDS, greatly stigmatized illness in the 80s and 90s. The way they changed public policy and changed public perception was to lift the veil of shame and secrecy around people with HIV/AIDS by using their own stories in the streets of many American cities, marching and standing up and speaking out and being identified. People with depression and other mental illnesses have made great strides in that area. Women with breast cancer, I mean, there's no better example of the power of our own stories than to see people wearing pink or running for the cure or all those things. We were late to the table, if you will, on the addiction with the illness that we're talking about today, alcoholism and drug dependence, because of shame and stigma. But perhaps more so because of a misunderstanding by many people who recover in 12-step programs. The anonymous piece, Alcoholics Anonymous, for example, really the tenet of that recovery circle, that element that's so strong has been the anonymity piece. Good. That's the way it should be. AA should not be involved in public discussion or in trying to change public policy. But as I make the case, and I think I've made it well, and again, using my own story over the decades, you can be in a recovery program that includes the 12 steps, that includes anonymity as a fundamental tenet, and you can still be an advocate. How? By standing up and speaking out as an addicted person in recovery and not standing up and speaking out as a member of a recovery group like AA. And it's taken us a long time, Brenda, a long time to get people to understand that they're not violating that tradition of anonymity. If they happen to be in that kind of group, they're not violating it. If they simply stand up and speak out and say, my name is William Moyers, I'm a person in recovery. I live in St. Paul. I pay taxes. I obey the law. I raise my family because I've overcome the illness of addiction, period. I don't speak out as a member of any 12-step group or any recovery group. And so have others become advocates. Even in this conversation we're having right now, I'm not talking to you as a member of any specific recovery group. I'm just talking to you as a person in recovery who got well. And so we've been mounting that effort for decades now. It sort of came to a head in this movie that you referenced, The Anonymous People, a couple of years ago. It was produced filmmaker Greg Williams from Connecticut. And that movie really sort of took the country by storm as it relates to recovery advocacy for addiction. That has manifested itself in a lot of recovery groups, advocacy groups down at the grassroots level in Missouri and in Minnesota and in most other states. And I think it all sort of came to a grand, not finale, but a grand conclusion for the moment. A year ago, October of 2015, when thousands of us rallied on the Washington Mall in the District of Columbia for a concert and a recovery advocacy celebration that featured Steven Tyler from Aerosmith and Joe Walsh of the Eagles and Sheryl Crow. And a lot of other entertainers. I got to get up on the stage in front of these thousands of people and speak out as a person in recovery. Point being that the recovery advocacy movement around addiction is alive and well in this country. It has managed to overcome this misunderstanding and this reluctance on the part of 12-step members to stand up and speak out. And I think we've got a lot of momentum now, and I think we're making, you know, we need to make more strides in the right direction, but we're doing that. And I'm very hopeful that, you know, in the years to come, addiction will be seen in the same light as breast cancer or heart disease or HIV/AIDS or depression.
I want to give out that website for the film because it does have information about the film and a companion book, and it's Many Faces, One Voice, and the number one is used as the number one. So manyfacesonevoice.org. You can preview the book. You can see the film. You can follow them on Twitter and Facebook, and you can join the movement. And I really want to give a shout-out for that. I hope we can sponsor that here in Missouri. I think it came for one night and sold out very quickly down in University City, but you can actually, it is now available on iTunes and on DVD and on Amazon. So it's available even on Netflix. So, you know, tell people to watch that film. If you're listening, watch it yourself. It will definitely be thought-provoking and wake you up into thinking about things maybe a little bit differently and what you can do to be involved in the movement. If you are or someone you love has had experience with addiction issues and or has found recovery or not, it's incredibly uplifting. What is Greg Williams working on now after that film?
You know, he did a second film that's just out a couple of months ago, or maybe it was actually in the fall. I'm drawing a blank right now on the name of it. It's about young people finding recovery. You know, there's another part of a misunderstanding around this illness is that it only affects old men or old women or, you know, people who live on the other side of the tracks or homeless people or so on. In fact, there are a lot of young people who become addicted very early on. I could become addicted very early on. I started using at 15 and found myself at the bottom at the age of 30. But a lot of people these days, a lot of young people find themselves addicted in their late teens, early 20s. And guess what? A lot of them find recovery at an early age too. What a gift. You know, what I tell young people all the time, you're so fortunate to be starting down this journey, as difficult as it is to be starting it now instead of waiting like I did. I wasted half of my teens and all of my 20s and half of my 30s finding recovery, goodness gracious. And, what you know, life is a gift, as we know, and it goes by very quickly, and here these young people are finding it. So Greg did a film about young people finding sustainable recovery and the fact that there is an alternative. You don't have to be an old person to find recovery. And it's very powerful. He's doing that now. He did partner, as I mentioned earlier, the Surgeon General's report. Greg and his organization, Facing Addiction, partnered with the Surgeon General's report on the big rollout of this important document. I was part of that as well in Los Angeles last November. It was very impressive.
Find that report? Like, is there a link?
Well, it's really easy. Just go to the United States Surgeon General. USA Today had a big story about the report on the day that it came out. I did some media around it. It came out in November of 2016. Real easy. Put in United States Surgeon General drug report, and it'll pop right up.
Okay.
There's some
also
very entertaining YouTube videos and other places you can find some interesting performances related to that report and also related to Facing Addiction concert on the Washington Mall.
And did they videotape that concert? Is that, I don't know how I missed hearing about that. I was probably busy at my store working through the holiday season and et cetera. But darn the luck. But we could all be doing those kinds of concerts in our own communities and hosting those kinds of concerts. Music is a great way to get a message across and get people, you know, involved. And so that's an idea, too. Did they tape it, though? Did they record that video?
Yes. Oh, yeah, there's a video. Oh, absolutely. It was professionally done. It was a very impressive day. There was a hurricane going up the East Coast that weekend, and so the National Parks Department, which had the permit for the rally on the mall, almost canceled the permit because of safety issues. But the storm sort of turned away at the 11th hour. And while it did affect the turnout, It was still an impressive turnout and an impressive event, and Greg and his production team did professionally tape the concert, and it's extremely powerful because there are well-known entertainers, like I said, Steven Tyler, Aerosmith, Sheryl Crow, and Joe Walsh, and a lot of others. I can't even name them all, but there they are performing on the National Mall, but doing so in the context of standing up and speaking out and singing the praises of recovery from addiction. It was a very powerful event, and the video, the DVD is out there and is sure worth it.
Awesome. And that website that you can find is as an addiction resource hub is facingaddiction.org. And there's all kinds of links there, housing, health and wellness counseling, legal prevention, recovery, all in one place. So that's a great place to start. And I know Hazleton has a fabulous website too. Do you want to tell us a little bit about what's available on the Hazleton website? And I know there's a lot of books and videos and things if someone wants to educate themselves further on this issue.
Yeah, sure, Brenda. We're now called the Hazel and Betty Ford Foundation because about a year and a half, 2 years ago, actually it's been 3 years, we merged with the Betty Ford Center, which is a well-known treatment facility in Southern California, started by Mrs. Ford, the First Lady. We merged a couple of years ago, so we're Hazel and Betty Ford, H-A-Z-E-L-D-E-N, Hazelden, Betty Ford. We do have a very good website, but we're known. You know, most of us, most people who know us as a treatment provider, and we are a treatment provider. We're a very good one. We're expanding. We're expanding more and more into outpatient. We used to be nothing but a residential facility, but now we've expanded into outpatient, and we're in many states. We're a not-for-profit, healthy not-for-profit. But we're much more than just a treatment provider. We have a publishing division. It's a major part of our business, and it produces all kinds of really interesting, you know, books and DVDs and other items that are all about the issues that you and I have talked about today. It's a fun place to go on the website, www.hazelandbettyford.org. We're a graduate school. We have an accredited graduate school. You can get your Master of Arts or Master of Science in Addiction Studies. We have a prevention unit that's very effective now, an organization called Freedom from Chemical Dependency, FCD. And that's used in a lot of schools, high schools around the country. So we're a prevention unit. We're a treatment unit. We're a publishing division. We have a lot of recovery support options. We really do represent the continuum, if you will, of this issue from prevention on the front end to treatment to counseling and to recovery on the back end. So you'll find a lot of interesting things if you go to the website. And we have, you know, we have an 800 number. I can't remember what it is right now, but we're easy to find. We have an 800 number if you're struggling with substances or have a family member who is, or a friend or a colleague at work. Don't hesitate to give us a call. A lot of people come to us for treatment, but more often than not, we end up referring people to other facilities more, you know, closer to home, or that's more clinically appropriate for what those people might need. But we are a resource. We are a beacon of hope and help and healing for people who are struggling in the darkness and in the shame and in the stigma of addiction.
And we have, gosh, this time has gone so fast. We need to talk about your new book. When is it coming out? What is the title, and how can people get it?
Well, I wrote Broken, My Story of Addiction and Redemption, hard to believe, 11 years ago, still in print, still relevant. But my story changed dramatically after that book came out in 2006. And I won't give away the story, but I hit bottom in 2008, and I hit bottom in recovery, which made it particularly painful. A lot has happened in my life since Broken came out, including a lot of loss, some hard times, some exuberant, successful times. And so the book I'm writing now is really another memoir. Broken was a memoir. As I said, still in print, still relevant, but a lot has changed. And so this book, which should be out in the second half of 2018, is the working title is Beyond Broken, The Rest of the Journey. Point being that a lot has happened in my journey since 2006, and I think this book will offer a lot of insight to people who want to know more, not just about addiction, but more about, you know, living life on life's terms after we put the substances down. So I think it's going to be a really, really good book. I think it's going to help a lot of people, and it certainly is going to update my story after so many years.
Wow. Well, we hope that when that book is finished that you come back to Missouri and we'll get to a large audience to hear your story and meet you. And I just think the more we can, like you said, the power is in the story. The real power is in the personal story. And, you know, your story can open minds, change hearts, and help families who are, I've heard, who are confused about addiction. I heard someone recently talking about her twin brother has recently become very addicted, is out on the streets and has been sleeping outside when it's been very, very cold. And she said, it's a choice. And I said, it's not a choice. At this point, he can want to quit at this point, and he can't. It has him in the grips of hell. Advice for someone like that who has a family member who is active in addiction, how to do an intervention, what to do, what not to do, any tips?
Well, every case is going to be a little different, but I'm glad that you asked me this question as we get ready to wrap it up here, because I think it's the sort of the message, the takeaway message for this past hour, which is there's always hope. Addiction is an illness that robs people of hope. And cloaks them in the shame and the stigma of this baffling condition. But there is hope. And the most important thing a family member can remember is that it is essential that you stay connected to the person who is struggling. They may not be ready to come in off the street. They may not be ready to stop using. But you want to keep that line of communication open with that person so that when they become ready, and they will become ready, they have that access to reach out to you and say, hey, Brenda, I need help. Can you help me? So keep that line of communication open. Keep talking to that loved one if that's who's struggling. Keep talking to that person and remind them that you're there for them to help them, that there is hope available, that treatment does work and recovery is possible, that addiction is not their fault, but it is their responsibility to recover from it. You can't get better with diabetes if you're not willing to take your insulin. You can't get better with heart disease if you're not willing to do what the doctor tells you to do around recovery. Same is true with addiction to alcohol and other drugs. You can stay in the problem, but if you want to find the solution, one, you got to ask for help. Two, you got to get help. And three, you got to be willing to invest in the solution. So I say to people all the time, there's always hope. Keep that line of communication open. Let that person know that you love them even while you may hate their illness and what their illness is doing. And then be there for them when they're ready to access care.
Awesome. Well, that is, there's really no way to end this conversation. It's just one little piece in the mosaic of information that everyone should expose themselves to, read up on. It's kind of ironic. I lived in Washington, D.C. for 14 years and Colorado for 6. And, I live out in the country now, and what would be considered by most sort of a quiet subdivision. And, we had 2 kids high on heroin come in to our house in the middle of the night while we were sleeping and stole some stuff. And, never in my years living in an urban populated area was I a victim of a crime. Like, that was kind of interesting. And, there is a drug ring out here in the rural areas. And, someone said, well, a lot of kids don't have things to do after school. They have, And in this situation, it was someone who had just gotten out of jail, recruited a good kid, senior local high school who had never gotten in trouble before and got involved with this other one and got hooked on drugs and, you know, committed this crime. And so sad because, you know, both of their lives now will be changed forever. But the more all of us can become empowered with this knowledge, and just something simple like reading William Cope Moyer's book called Broken, and educating yourself on various personal stories. Coming to the panel workshop, February 27th, St. Peter's Cultural Arts Center, 6:30. Come and learn more about substance abuse, how to recognize the warning signs, how to help a family member, you know, the various support systems that are out there. Get involved, educate yourself, and get involved as an advocate. Speak out. Do not be a silent bystander. Call your state representatives and your federally elected people, and definitely download this new Surgeon General report. I just put it on the link on Facebook so people can find that and download and share that, and we'll continue this conversation moving forward. And William, I know this won't be our last conversation, but the first of many more to come. So thank you so much for making time for us today.
Well, you're welcome, Brenda, and thank you for giving me and the Hazel and Betty Ford Foundation the opportunity to be on your show to carry the message of hope and help and healing to people who struggle with addiction and deserve to experience the promise and possibility of recovery. Thanks a lot.
Well, thank you. You're the second one from Hazleton. Actually, we had Karen Casey on a few years ago, so she also has been down here to Missouri several times teaching a workshop in the fall. So thank you, William. Have a fabulous
You're
weekend.
Welcome.
Love you and your family, and happy Valentine's Day.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Take care.
Thank you, Sean. Bring them
down. We'd like to sing another number. Hey. All right. This is another song with My Alaya Sayalon, My Ayose, My Sayalon. And this song goes Nowhere Man in E.
He's a real nowhere man.